session number 28361, reel 46.
General Julian Thompson, you're saying that Mike Clapp had left behind radio operators and other means to deceive the Argentinians about the task group, but the amphibious task group, but the Secretary of State had given the game away by mentioning its departure from Ascension. When you sailed from Ascension, did you have a mission statement?
Our plan had not been approved, and we hadn't been given a mission yet.
So you were still sailing blind from that
point of view? We're still sailing blind. And then we at this stage the logistic ships have gone ahead. We sent them ahead at the end of April, and we sailed from Ascension on the 6th of May. And just before we left Ascension, we got a signal a couple of days before we left Ascension. Which was too northward from Sandy, but copied to me, and it was exclusive, and it was saying that he was not confident that he was going to win the air battle, and in it it contained the phrase, which I remember quite well, that the price of a ticket on a train about to leave Ascension is going to be very expensive. So you didn't need to be a rocket scientist to work out that he was saying we're liable to take heavy casualties as a result of not winning the air battle. And I was quite worried by this, and I wrote a letter which I sent back to England by hand of officer, because we were still at Ascension, so we were being visited by a staff officer from Northwood, and I gave him this letter and said, give it to Jeremy Moore, in which I said, we will, of course, do exactly as we're told, but carrying out amphibious operations without first securing our superiority is not a recommended practice. And I got an answer back, which I don't think Jeremy Moore had penned, but came from the task force commander, which more or less said, don't worry, which of course isn't an answer, because it can mean one of two things. It can mean, don't worry, because we're going to do something about it, or don't worry, just get on with what you're told and don't concern us with your little problems. Which was not particularly reassuring. After we had sailed, indeed on the 12th of May, we received approval that our plan to land at San Carlos was approved. It had been approved all the way up to the cabinet, I believe. We also received two or three other things. One was notification that the command structure was to change.
Again,
and it was going to be Fieldhouse Woodward Moore, and under Moore, and Clapp Fieldhouse. Sorry, let me start again. Fieldhouse at the top, Woodward, Clapp, Moore, all equal on that line, and below Moore, myself and Tony Wilson, the commander of the 5th Infantry Brigade. So we were stepping down, and this was to reflect the arrival of General Moore in the Falklands, but it was some time before he did arrive.
Did you know anything about Tony Wilson?
I met him, but I didn't know anything else about him, no. It was quite important, this business of command change, because the commander, say, was changed on about the 12th, and we didn't land until the 21st, and General Moore didn't appear in the Falklands until the 30th. So for a long time, the command structure did not reflect reality on the ground. And I'll come to that later.
Now, you mentioned the being perturbed by the air threat on your way down. What about the submarine threat? Was that something that gave you any cause for concern?
I mean, it didn't give me any cause for concern at all. Not that I wasn't worried about being sunk by submarine, but there was nothing I could do about it. Therefore, there was no point in worrying about it. And I had pretty good faith in the Navy's anti-submarine ability. I mean, it was one of the things it was actually quite good at. Probably the best navy in the world had anti-submarine. And so if they couldn't protect us, no one could. And I was quite clear that they were going to do everything they possibly could to make certain that the troop ships weren't sunk. So I didn't actually give it a thought.
What about the threat from the air, though? Is there anything you thought you might be able to do about that?
There was nothing I could do about it. But I was concerned about it. And I was concerned that we'd actually get heavy casualties on the run-in before we actually got there, when we were within range and hadn't landed. Once we were ashore, I didn't worry too much about the air threat, in the sense that, you know, it wasn't going to stop us getting ashore because we were already ashore, but it was worried me in the sense that it was going to make resupply, logistics and everything very difficult, because our line of communication, which was inevitably by helicopter or by sea, was going to be vulnerable to air attack. So the air side did worry me a lot, and it worried Mike Clapp a lot too. And it led to the agreed timing of HR. I wanted to land last light, so I'd have all night, 14 hours of winter night, to get sorted out before first light. Mike wanted to land at first light, because he'd have all 14 hours to approach in darkness. So we sliced it down the middle, and we arrived in the lowering position, which is where you drop the anchor and started going at midnight. So his
statesmanlike compromise.
Statesmanlike compromise, and the rationale was that I'd then have half the night to get sorted out, and he'd have half the night for the final approach, which would be the most dangerous time,
because he'd be in the narrower waters.
Narrower waters, closer to Argentina,
yeah,
and so forth. Mm. There were a number of sort of other little things. We did actually eventually get a mission. And can you stop the tapes? Because oh. I want to.
Can you remember when you actually got that mission?
The final mission.
No, the one you're about to.
The one I'm about to. The first mission was was land with a view to repossessing.
Yeah.
And that was soon after that Council of War at Ascension, i.e., mid-April. But on the 12th of May, we received an op order. This is after we've sailed from Ascension, and we've actually written our own op order on the basis that we can't hang around any longer.
So you've got a brigade op order?
I've got a brigade op order written.
And a task group op order?
Well, no, we each wrote our own op orders, because I'll come back to the system in a minute.
It's bringing autonomy to a high level, isn't it?
Yes, but it works better that way, for the reason that I'll come back to in a minute. And on the 12th of May, we got CTF's op order with a new mission: repossess the Falkland Islands as quickly as possible.
that's clear and unambiguous.
Which is clear and unambiguous. At the same time, we got this change of command structure, and we also got a directive from Jeremy Moore, which I won't read out completely, but unless you want me to read it out.
If it's material to your account.
Okay, well, I will read it out in that case. You're to secure a bridgehead on East Falkland into which reinforcements can be landed, in which an airstrip can be established, and from which operations to repossess the Falkland Islands can be developed. You are to push forward from the bridgehead area so far as the maintenance of its security allows, to gain information and to forward the ultimate objective of repossession. You will retain operational control of all forces landed in the Falklands until I establish my headquarters in the area. It is in my intention to do this aboard Fearless as early as practicable after the landing. I expect this to be approximately on D plus 7. In fact, it was on D plus 9. It is my intention to land 5th Infantry Brigade into the bridgehead and to develop operations for the complete repossession of the Falkland Islands. Now, from that...
One thing about that is that, contrary to the sort of operations order that might have been issued during the Second World War,
yep,
there's no mention there of the destruction of enemy forces.
No. No. And also, there are a number of other ambiguities. You are to push forward so far as the maintenance of the security of the bridgehead allows, to gain information, and to forward the ultimate aim of repossession. There's no mention of the centre of gravity of the enemy. And it is my intention to land 5th Infantry Brigade into the bridgehead and develop operations for the complete repossession of the Falkland Islands. Iron Mike Clapp read into that that we were to secure the bridgehead, we were to biff enemy nearby, we would do many things to lead up to, but we were not to move out to the bridgehead, or I wasn't, in any strength until the arrival of the 5th Infantry Brigade. That's what I read into that whole order.
The traditional role of amphibious assault forces is to take and secure a beachhead,
isn't it?
From which presumably then other forces will...
Or the same force.
Will deploy, all the same force.
Yeah, sure.
Yes.
So that's what I and Mike, as we talked about it quite a lot, read into that. Mm. We queried the CTF op order, the first which we received on the 12th, because there were certain things in it which could be said to be ambiguous.
Because
it mentioned six phases, and the sixth phase came after the arrival of Jeremy Moore and was the repossession of the whole islands. Mm-hmm. Was that to be, well, we were there on our own, was it to be later or what? And so we queried that, and we got an answer back, which didn't actually provide an answer at all to what we were querying. And it came up with some pretty curious other things as well, which by this time, I don't think Jeremy Moore was having a hand in what was being said.
Why not?
Because I think he was about to move out, and so... Dick Tranton moved
in. He was preparing to
move off.
Displace down to
exactly,
Portland.
Exactly. Mm. In it, it said, this answer, second answer, it said, we must still aim to close the main enemy at Port Stanley. Then up with this extraordinary statement, static defensive positions there will be destroyed piecemeal, making maximum use of artillery, naval gunfire support and close air support. Well, no properly educated officer talks about destroying positions using artillery. Artillery, as you know, only neutralizes, and certainly light artillery isn't about to destroy any position, nor is naval gunfire support. And so it was a very, very suspect statement, which meant absolutely nothing, really.
And where was all close air support going to?
Exactly. Well, the close air support was going to come from the GR3 Harriers that were being sent down an Atlantic conveyor, or the Sea Harriers when they weren't providing cap.
Yeah.
So,
who do you think had written this order then?
I think it had been written by Fieldhouse's staff. And it was not clear. And I think it was one of the problems. Was that because there was no in-theatre commander down south or near us, we couldn't go and say, look, this isn't clear. There was no chap to sort of exercise what I would call face-to-face command, which I think is very important, where you find out what's concerning your subordinates. And you also, I mean, you're there to sort of pat them on the back and kick them up the bottom. But there wasn't any of that. And as a result, there were a lot of misunderstandings that could have been avoided later, I'm sure. So by the 12th, we've got all this stuff, and from that we extract, we've got to land, and we've got to do as much as we can to close up Port Stanley, etc. And I then hold an O group on the 13th, and I issue my 47-page op order, a copy of which I have here, if you want to see it, before the O group, somewhat unusual.
The normal thing would be to issue the op order after the exactly. Aid memoir.
Exactly.
Well, why did you do it the other way around?
I did it the other way around quite deliberately, because I was not going to go through the whole thing page by page at the O group. I wanted the O group to be a crisp orders from me about what I wanted them to do, not how they were going to do it. I wanted them to come to it, bearing in mind that at least two of the CEOs had never done an amphibious exercise, operation, or anything in their lives, so already having absorbed things like the grouping, the phases, and some of the other stuff which would be new and which I didn't want to be new to them at an O group. And at the O group was merely restricted to the key bones of it, and it was in a traditional style, starting with intelligence given by the G3 int, and enemy forces given by the G3 int, and then the BM gave a quick burst on friendly forces. I then gave the mission and the execution paragraph of the order, and then followed a very brief burst on administration logistics, the meat of which was in that order, and a quick burst on command and signals, the meat of which was in the order. And I then, having done that, followed up with two things that I wanted them to absolutely hoist in. One was that the landing is only a beginning and is not an end in itself, and is to be the move out is what's going to be the important bit, and the fighting thereafter. The second was that they were to tell their troops no one was to halt for a casualty. They were to bypass their own casualties, and their stretcher bearers and other people following up would pick up the casualties. What I was worried about was the sort of Northern Ireland syndrome that everything stops for a casualty. The war stops while you all group round the casualty.
Was this to apply to the whole run of operations,
yep,
or simply to the landing?
Everybody. The whole time. The landing, any subsequent operation.
And exploitation of the landing.
Everything. Mm. They were to follow what was standard procedure in the Second World War, which is you press on past your casualties, which we'd grown out of as a peacetime army. And I wanted to make that point because I thought it was terribly important. Those are the only two points that I made subsequent to the O Group. I then asked if there were any questions, and there were none.
What did you know at that stage about enemy forces? What could you relay to the...
We could relay to them that there was an enemy company in the vicinity of the beach. We could relay to them that there was a brigade plus round Stanley, which had equipment XYZ, so many guns, so many... Where exactly they were, we did not know. We could relay to them one incorrect piece of information which had been being given, which led me to... which we received later. Sorry, I'm running ahead of it. And that was about all we could tell them. And after the O Group, and we got a bit of GCHQ information, which told us that there was what the Argentines call their strategic reserve, which was a misnomer. They actually meant their tactical reserve, sitting at Goose Green, which was uncomfortably close to the southern part of the beachhead. Yeah. And I thought if they really got their act together, they could cause us a problem, particularly if they got wind that we were coming.
Well, they could come in on your southern flank.
That's right. So I changed the landing order. Landing order originally was going to be 40 commando and 45 commando landing simultaneously, one on one side of the bay and the other on the other, with San Carlos. And then the follow-up waves would be two para landing in behind 40 at San Carlos and three para landing at Port San Carlos. And I changed it so that I put 40 commando and two para ashore together at San Carlos. And two para's mission was to get up onto Sussex Mountain, which is the high ground blocking off that southern approach, ASP.
So they had the role of flank guard.
They would be the flank guard. Mm-hmm. So... that changed the landing order, but that doesn't matter because the landing order is designed in such a way, the landing plan, that you can switch things around over the radio if necessary and change people around. It doesn't make life difficult. Now the op orders, you asked about the op orders. My op order was telling my people what to do. The naval op order is telling the bus conductors how they will drive their buses and trams and taxis to take people from A to B.
So they've got to have a schedule and an itinerary, haven't they?
They've got to have a schedule and itinerary. And that is done in the form of a thing called an OpGen Alpha, is the navalese for it, and it's sent out by signal.
Yeah.
And all it is giving timings and things like boat lanes, helicopter approach and retirement. It's not, you don't need to bother the troops with it. All they know is they're catching a boat at such and such a time, which takes them to that, and then they start doing things.
But the naval operators need to know timings,
places,
bearings, routes, distances.
Sure, and all they need to know, I mean, all the Navy needs to be told is, I want to land on that beach there. I'm not interested in how they then
get you there,
what anchor positions they pick up in order to take me there. So there's no need to produce a bloody great, you know, thick thing like that which applies to everybody, because it just means there's more reading, or probably more, you know, people just throw it away. So then we got a wobbler. We had originally meant, intended, and we told Northwood this, to land 3 para and 40 commando and 4-2 commando from Canberra, 2 para from Norland, and 4-5 commando from Stromness. We were then told that carrying 3 battalions in Canberra was not acceptable, and therefore we were to take out 2 of them and put them in other ships. Now, at this stage, we were in the South Atlantic. Had we been told that beforehand, and we did contemplating shifting people about, we would have gone into South Georgia, where you've got a calm anchorage, and shifted people about. Mm. And the reason we rejected that was the trip from South Georgia, 900 miles from South Georgia to the Falkland Islands, against the prevailing wind, will take you 3 days.
Three and a half days.
Mm. Chaps in overload ships, ships that are at maximum overload, people sleeping on the deck, in passageways, sleeping in landing craft. 3 nights with no proper sleep is not a very good recipe for about to carry out an operation of landing plus God knows how many days and nights of fighting afterwards. So I rejected it. In the end, we were ordered to do it at sea. And luckily, we had what was the South Atlantic, calm enough weather, it was just marginal, and we were able to move 3 para out to Intrepid and 40 commando into Fearless.
How did you move?
By landing craft.
Landing craft.
Yeah, so they went to Canberra. Luckily, they'd practiced it lots of times. Mm. They were originally going to do it for the landing. They now had to do it in daylight, of course. And they were taken into the... Now, the disadvantages of that were the Navy had to change their boat schedules, but that could be done quite easily because it's flexible. But the major disadvantage is suddenly...
What about the loading of the landing craft?
Well, that's easy. That's much easier.
No problem then.
Because the landing craft are in the dock, and you just come down and you get in the landing craft and you open the doors and they go. Mm. So that bit's easier. But the problem is you now put 3 para in a ship which they've never seen before, which they're going to have to find their way around in the night, with red lighting, cumbered with packs, narrow passageways, not nice wide liner type passageways and stairwells. And the same with the 40 Commando and Fearless, except that they were Marines and many of them had been in that ship. Mm. Well, not many, but some had been in that ship before. So that was an embuggerance, but it did work. The second thing was, we then got this information about the enemy's, they call strategic, of course, tactical reserve at...
Goose Green.
At Goose Green, which caused me to change the landing plan. Mm. But again, that wasn't serious. We now come to...
Presumably the paras had been briefed earlier.
They were going to the same beach, in the same landing craft.
They
were going to go to Sussex Mountain. All I was doing was bringing their serial forward.
So
they were going to do the same thing earlier.
Yeah,
so there was no problem. Which is why I chose them. I didn't want to muck around with, you know, putting different people there.
Of course.
And 4-2 Commando were going to be my float reserve in Canberra, inside San Carlos. Logistics is quite important at this stage because Canberra we were going to use as the field dressing station, as one of the field dressing stations, not as a hospital ship. People mistake that. The hospital ship was the Uganda, which was a designated under the Geneva Convention hospital ship, white painted, lit up, red crosses, etc. No coded radio sets allowed on board, no weapons, nothing. All messages to be passed in clear. Canberra was going to have one FDS on board, and I was going to land one FDS. The aim being that though there was covered accommodation where my FDS was going to go in an old mutton factory, it gave me 2 FDSs split, and I had all the facilities that Canberra would give me of, you know, water, light, clean surroundings, all that sort of an FDS. And we'll come on to what we ended up with later. And I think that was really all about the plan. And on the last day, which was the run-in, And luckily it was thick fog, drizzle. The Argentine Air Force had no success in finding us.
Had you been aware of Argentine aircraft looking for you earlier on your approach?
We were too far out.
Yeah, so you hadn't had any maritime reconnaissance?
The only maritime reconnaissance that took place was actually, in fact, we did have it. I'm wrong. Yeah. I'm wrong. Two cases of it. One was Russian bears flying over us a lot of the time.
Long way from
home. Conquery.
Ah, in Guinea.
In Guinea. Yeah. and they didn't follow us all the way south. They followed us a long way south. The other was Argentine civil airliners who were carrying out recces. And what Mike did was he converted Atlantic Conveyor. He took one of the Sea Harriers out of its wraps on Atlantic Conveyor. There were some coming forward as replacements. And you could take off vertically and do that. And he was going to use the Sea Harrier to shoot down this airliner. But at that stage, the rules of engagement didn't allow it, thank God. Because on one occasion, the airliner came over, which he would have launched, and it turned out to be a perfectly innocent airliner on his way.
What nationality was it? Was it Argentine?
It was Argentine, yeah. Argentine airliner. Mm. But it was, you know, full of passengers and not chaps doing wreckage. Mm. So, but those were the only wreckages. But no warplanes came and had a look at us. We were too far away. Mm. And on the last morning, the Opgen Alpha had been transmitted the day before, because from midnight, D-1, we were on radio silence, and all messages were by light or by helicopter. And
by light, was this by the traditional old-fashioned Aldous lamp?
Yeah, well, a searchlight on the ship, the big signalling lamp,
yes.
Which you have on a ship, which the Navy still uses. Mm. It's jolly useful if you're in radio silence.
Of course.
The literalizer in Norland, which is the thing that ungobbledygooks the messages, broke down. So they didn't get the...
this would be two power.
Two power. Didn't get the message about...
the accelerated plan.
No, they got that, because I went and told them that. What they didn't get the message was, because the Opgen Alpha, which went out the day before, gives you the time of D-Day and the time of HR.
Yeah.
They thought they knew when it was, and they had the info, but they hadn't got confirmation of it, which is what they needed. And they suddenly saw, all the ships purposefully steaming in close formation. They thought, well, it's about to happen. And so eventually the Norland signaled by light to Fearless, saying, do we not know something we should know? I.e., we don't know, we haven't had the Opgen Alpha. So the Opgen Alpha was put in a bag, a bit of paper in a bag, and given to a frigate shot across, and who shot it across on a thing called a Costin gun line, where it landed on the deck, and they were able to get confirmation of the time of HR, and the D-Day was really tomorrow. So those are the little sort of things that attended the run-in, and the final thing attending the run-in was the tying together of a plan to deal with the people we call the Fanning Head mob, who were the people sitting on Fanning Head
overlooking.
Yeah. And we confirmed their location early that night with the thermal imaging. And then a hit team was put in the antrim, consisting of naval gunfire support team and SBS, who were going to close with this position and call down fire from HMS Antrim onto it and neutralize them, so they couldn't probably destroy them, but neutralize them. Hopefully they'd surrender. They didn't actually, but it would keep them busy and keep their minds off what was going on around them.
What sort of firepower did Antrim have?
Well, Antrim was actually is effectively the equivalent of a light cruiser. She was a county class destroyer, and she had 8 4.5 inch guns.
That's a formidable battery.
That is a formidable, so she was, she could bring down quite a bit. Sorry, not 8. She had, they'd taken the, I think she had 6 4.5, which is enough. And that was going to bring down a heavy weight of fire. I mean, that's equivalent to about three batteries of artillery at the speed at which they were pumping them out. So that was really the lead up to D-Day, the 21st of May. Mm.